Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
I'm Justin.
Today, we got another leisure list for you. We're going to do something different next week, I promise. Stay for the end. We'll tell you what it is. So, for those of you just tuning in, leisure list is a potpourri of entertainment where we pick basically whatever we're watching lately. So, getting into our medium shot, we'll tell you what the list actually is today. My first one, Critical Role, Campaign 1.
Hey, my first one will be Titan Mage.
Asteroid City.
Marry My Husband.
And the 1990s Addams Family movies. I'm combining them together.
And the Hobbit audiobook.
I'll also be talking in my quick pick section at the very end when I tell you the very best thing I've watched that didn't make the list here. Action Comics, The Arena. And we're going to be trying to do a non-spoiler review. I mean, there will be some spoilers, but nothing that'll ruin it for you. Just basically, if you don't like the premise and a little bit of plot information, it's probably too much spoilers for you. But otherwise, we're going to be talking about 10 minutes on each thing, and I will kick this off with Critical Role Campaign 1. An epic story about a found family of misfits and outcasts who wind up responsible for the safety of their world during a period of great strife, while they help one another reach their potential through personal, emotional trials and challenges. And I really enjoy Critical Role Campaign. I mean, this is it is a in-person thing that they did as well at the time, and they still do, but this is over 400 hours of content, just this campaign that they ran. I mean, it's 115 episodes, most of them 4 hours apiece.
You finished all of them?
In audio form, that's my point. I didn't have the time to watch it, sit down and watch it. But, you know, I listened to half an hour at a time on my commutes. That's how I got through it. So that's the big sell, really, is do you have that time? And I do think it impacts your enjoyment of it. To watch it, having seen the clips of it, I think it is better watching it because you get to see, you know, these voice actors really are acting in it. They're really inhabiting their characters in a way that it feels like you're watching a theatrical performance in a way, except they're all sitting around a table just talking and rolling dice. But the audios are also very immersive too, because I can imagine everything that's going on in the world. Basically, what I liked about it is Critical Role uses its medium and the talents of its actors to craft one of the most immersive story worlds I've yet heard. And for those of you who don't know what Critical Role is, maybe you're living under a rock or you just haven't hit that part of the internet yet, but it is a D&D show, or at least it was. They're not anymore going forward. They made their own system, but it started as basically it was a birthday party gift for Liam O'Brien, one of the members, where he got a bunch of his voice actor friends together and they played a game of Dungeons and Dragons together. And then they had a home game and all these people played together for a while and they had a good time. And then they decided to stream themselves doing it. And they were the first ones to really do this at the time. Dungeons and Dragons streams weren't really a thing, let alone with a cast of professional voice actors who are inhabiting these characters as professionally and with as much investment into them as they would a professional job that they do for a living. Mostly they voice video game characters.
Mm-hmm.
But Dungeons and Dragons is in its way, it's like playing an RPG, except you're not limited by coding. You can do whatever you want. This isn't to sell you all on Dungeons and Dragons, but that's the context for what Critical Role is. As they announce at the top of basically every episode, a bunch of nerdy-ass voice actors who get together and play D&D, roll dice, and play Dungeons and Dragons. And so, a bit about Campaign 1. It follows the adventures of a group called Vox Machina. And as I said at the start, there are a bunch of misfits and weirdos. They all come from different backgrounds, like Percival, Frederick Steinbaum, Musil Kowalski, Devorlo III, is an aristocrat who was kicked out of his family home. Most of his family have been murdered, and he's on a quest for vengeance. Okay, then you have Keyleth. She's a druidic princess from the Arashari. She's looking to complete her Aramente and become the leader of her people. It's like a spirit quest to help her get the tools to become a good leader. Then there's the twins, Vaxeldon and Vexalia. They are half-elves who were sort of shunned from their home, have some serious daddy issues, so they're kind of just wandering around as mercenaries, and they're pretty much all they have, a family with each other. There's Scanlan, a womanizing bard who goes around Exandria and tells great tales of things, and he's a very charismatic person who has a lot of growing to do. He doesn't like to get close to people. There's Grog, a simpleton, a jolly giant who is very, very dumb, but very loyal at the same time. He's the muscle of the group and just gets everyone into fun situations. There's also Pike. She's a cleric who is going on a bit of a spiritual journey as well. And I'm probably forgetting somebody right now, but anyway, those are most of the main group of characters. Oh, and of course the dungeon master, Matthew Mercer, who's putting all this together. And basically all these people in their dynamic, they're playing out a story that Matt Mercer created in his world of Exandria, and it's an incredibly immersive and vividly detailed world where some of the places they go to are based on Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition places, but Matt Mercer puts his own spin on it. He has a ton of original enemies he makes for the game, and he managed to take this 115-episode story spanning 4 hours per episode with 7 main characters, a whole ton of supporting characters, and craft a story that is cohesive and emotionally investing with grand payoff that'll make you laugh, cry, everything in between, makes you feel everything, because there is so much time in this world that, for better and for worse, and I'll get into why for both, it feels like you're just existing in a world. And I think that's one thing people will have some problems with, is it sometimes it drags a little bit, because not every one of those episodes has big plot things happening. But it's one of those shows where you kind of just have to go for the ride, because if they're not advancing the main plot, they might be doing a shopping session or a character building session or something random. But sometimes those are the best ones in the show. Just those totally random side adventures where Grog and Scanlan go shopping for something and get into trouble in the religious capital of the world. Just, it has nothing to do with the main plot or them trying to save the world. It can be totally goofy and feel completely pointless, and you're fully on board for it at the same time. And then there's other ones where they do stuff like that and it just feels like, why are we wasting time here? So there is a bit of give and take, but really you just come to love these characters so much, and their dynamic and their interactions with each other, that you want to see them explore the world, fight all kinds of enemies, and help each other grow as people. That's really a big part of it, is these world-ending stakes with the Chroma Conclave or the Briarwoods or other enemies later on, they wouldn't feel as impactful if you didn't really care about all these core characters and their stories and their relationships with each other and how they grow and change over the course of a couple years in in-game time. And I think it really helps that these voice actors who are playing these characters all have an amazing chemistry in real life. The way they interact with each other at the table, they do feel like a family. And that comes through in their characters, which they'd already been playing a couple years before it even went to stream. So real life is bleeding into the game that these people know what they're doing, and you just feel their chemistry through and through.
Now, you're talking about the chemistry. Isn't there a character who's missing from, like, the Vox Machina TV show?
That would be... Why can't I remember his name? Orion Akabra, I think, is the actor his name was. He started on Critical Role. Why can't I remember his name right now? Yeah, he was a sorcerer character, and he started in the home game with them, and he was in the first couple dozen episodes of the stream, and then he left. There's a bit of drama there, which nobody's entirely sure what happened, but suffice it to say, he wasn't super popular with the fans of the stream, and he also didn't gel as amazingly with the rest of the table. Led to some awkward moments, some people argue. But once he was gone, especially, everything coalesced even more. So, yeah, the character arcs are exceptional. It's just, these actors are just so amazing to be so consistent with their portrayals, down to the smallest character quirks, for 115 episodes straight. It's just top, you're just watching top tier talent at work, and a bunch of friends who happen to be very entertaining at a table together, with Matt Mercer's masterful storytelling. He, once again, is not always amazingly paced. There's a couple arcs, the very first one in particular. The first 14 episodes are more rough to get through because they don't really know what they're doing yet for the streaming. But it's, a lot of people recommend skipping the first 14 or so episodes and then just going right into the next arc. But,
well, I mean, realistically, it started
3 years before that.
Like, in their midway through the campaign anyways, so.
Exactly. So it kind of just hits the ground running. They're in the middle of something that we have no context for. So it's a lot of people kind of like that, though. The world is already existing. You just get dropped in. Vox Machina is already together. There's no beginning to this story, except for what you hear through exposition way later on. But there's so many scenes in this show that are, it's top tier drama and comedy and everything in between. It's as good as watching a TV show that's got great dialogue, and like the lines these guys can pull out of nowhere with their improv capabilities in character. It can be anything from just badass to hilarious to genuinely moving. And it all happens on the spot. The emotions are all crafted right there at the table, and you can feel it as it's unfolding. And it only falls short of my highest ranking just because of the time investment. Not everyone's got 400 hours even for a commute to listen to an audio. Let alone watch it.
So that's why you watch the TV show.
Yes, watch The Legend of Vox Machina TV show, which you're caught up on that, right? You have,
yep.
Yeah, that was what got me in the first place, was the first two seasons of Legend of Vox Machina. And I caught up most of Critical Role by the time, most of Campaign 1 by the time Season 3 came. By the time Season 3 came, I'd already passed that part, and I was starting to play comparison games. But that's a very faithful adaptation, and that's only a couple dozen episodes if you want to get the gist of this story without all the really fun side bits in the middle that they chop out for time. That's really the only drawback of the TV show, is that it is a stripped-down TV show, mostly focusing on the plot. Okay, we got to get from A to B here. Less time for the weird antics in the middle that made the live show so memorable and really showed you the little eccentricities of these characters when the world wasn't always on, you know, and ending stakes, right? It's all about seeing the characters in all kinds of different environments. But I love Legend of Vox Machina, the TV show. I love Critical Role Campaign 1. It's you get to know these characters better than basically any piece of media I've ever consumed. I feel like I know all the little quirks and eccentricities of every member of Vox Machina.
Well, you better after that much time.
Oh, yeah. And you're just entertained the entire time. It's rarely a dull moment. So, like I said, it only ekes out from my highest ranking just because of the time investment to it. But I do think for TTRPG fans, or even people just looking to get into a very immersive and well-told story, it's a must-see or must-listen or however you want to consume it. And, you know, I'll get back to you guys in a couple of years when I'm finally done campaign 2. I'm going to be starting that one soon. So, what you got?
Well, I did it again. Oops. It's another smut novel. I got to admit, when I'm choosing my things on Audible, it's like midway through work, I'm like, okay, something ended. I'm going to pick something else. Sure, this sounds interesting. I don't read the descriptions near well enough. But I was surprisingly impressed with this one. Basically, it's about a guy who gets transported to another universe where he gets to pilot this giant mech and fight things from space that come down, and he's in like a fantasy world. And he's also super cool, and every woman wants to sleep with him.
This is Titan Mage, just to
yes,
be clear.
Yes, Titan Mage, sorry. I don't know why I didn't say that.
You want to get a little suspense going.
Yeah. But, what do I want to say about it? The world building was really good. I was very impressed with it. It's a really, really cool universe. Despite being a smut novel, there's actually like logic behind some of the stuff, and it's very interesting. It also comes across very much like a female author trying her very best to write what she believes to be the ultimate male fantasy. It totally comes across that way. I didn't even know the author was a female till later, and I was like, that tracks. It totally makes sense for that.
Yeah.
All of the characters are really good, other than maybe the main guy is a little... He's a main character. He just fills that role. But all three of the girls on the ship are all unique. And each book actually went into basically a different character. There ends up being 5 women on the ship, and each book is focused on their kind of backstory, like not going into their backstory, but bringing their backstory to light in the current time and having it actually matter, which was really cool. That they actually got to spend time with each character. But, you know, there's 5 books and 5 female characters. As you can tell, the main character he's a meat puppet, basically. There's not much to him at all. He's just very generic is the issue with that one. But the world itself is very, very cool. You know, they've got like the crystal moon shoots stuff at the ground, and they got to fight stuff from it. And there's so much going on in the world that actually I would have liked to see more expanded upon of this fantasy world, because it's somehow a mix of fantasy that's like, yeah, it's really out there for some parts, but then it's grounded in other ways as well. Like, they all fly around on airships. There's nothing beyond that. And it reminds me a lot of Mass Effect, where a lot of the stuff they're running on is it's technology from what they call the precursors, and they have no idea how some of this stuff works. They have absolutely no idea, but they're still using it. They use it all in all sorts of things. It's just very fascinating, and it deals with, like, there's different regions, and it all stays fairly self-contained, but you learn a lot about the different regions in the world and how their cultures impact how they deal with this different world.
Yeah, so you said earlier that it's written nearly like it's trying to be the ultimate male fantasy. How well do you think it succeeds in that?
I don't know. It depends.
Did it succeed in your fantasy?
Would
you want to be this man?
Well, I mean, piloting the giant mech sounds kind of cool. I mean, there's a lot of things to like there, but it's like, you know, if I had to handcraft my own fantasy, it'd be different.
I believe you showed me the cover of the book, and it said harem fantasy, specifically.
Yeah, I did. I could not see that, because on Audible, the covers, when you're, like, clicking on stuff, is, like, really small on the screen. The covers is... And I showed you the first cover. It's like, okay, yes, there is a girl on the cover, but it's not, like, explicit or anything. There's a giant robot and a girl next to it. That's about it. But I had the omnibus, so all five were blended into one under one cover. But when you look at the other covers, it's pretty obvious what you're going into.
Yes.
So don't go into it expecting that it's not a smut novel, because it totally goes into smut, like, whenever possible.
But it's actually good in its own right. You can go into it for the smut, but also they made five of these things, so... Yeah.
It's not bad. The world is really cool, so... I don't know. If you can... Even if the smut is not your thing, if...
There's more to it.
Yeah. You don't have to enjoy the smut to enjoy the novel, because it's that well done. And there's a lot of humor to it. And sometimes you can even see where the writer was coming from as they're going. And it just leads for a lot of interesting stuff. It was really good. I actually, if it was bad, I would have stopped listening to it. It was very long. The five of them was like over 50 hours. So it's not short. When like the average audiobook, like something that's fairly long, is usually like 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Lord of the Rings is the first book is only like 15, 20 hours. So, you know, this is quite long when it's basically as long as the entirety of Lord of the Rings.
So remind me what the goal here is. Are they just traveling around from world to world, seeing what's there book by book? Or is there a...
Well, it's all self-contained in one world. They travel, they're doing like work. They basically just deal with mostly these meteors that come down from the moon with these slime things, and, you know, they got to kill them. Okay. But then you deal with stuff where it's like, okay, these things can take control of creatures or equipment or anything that's been left behind. Sometimes it's like precursor equipment. They're like, oh, this is really bad. But there's multiple of the Titans, and they're all unique, and everything is cool. It's really interesting how they did the Titans as well, because it's called Titan Mage because there's magic. But you can only use the magic when you're touching the right material. You have to have like a material component to it. So the Titans themselves have to have certain materials or stuff for them to actually use the magic.
Can anybody access this magic, or is it specific?
No, not everybody can, and most people can use like one type of magic, maybe two. There's four types of magic. Yeah, four. And that's why everybody wants to sleep with this guy, is because he's got all four types of magic. He's super special. And they're all like, it's like, oh, he's a void mage. So, and they're like, okay, in our society, if you have a child with a void mage, the government will pay for everything. And they're like, pregnancy lasts 1 week because we have time magic and we accelerate it. So it's like, oh, they're all like, you. Me? What? What did I do?
Oh, right. I'm a void mage. Of course you want me.
He sticks pretty close, though, considering, you know, when they go somewhere in public and it's like, everybody knows him and he's being approached like all the time. He sticks pretty close to his girls, but still he wants to have a collection. And it's a little strange. It's a little out there for me, but it was cool enough. The premise had me hooked. So
does this guy's ego just expand over time or what?
Totally. Totally. Eventually, yes. He doesn't completely like explode with ego, but he definitely gets up there. Like at first he's pretty hesitant about it. Then he's just like, yeah, whatever.
But he never becomes too insufferable.
No, he's not like super arrogant. I mean, sometimes it's a little odd because you're like, okay, this guy just showed up into this world. He doesn't really understand anything. And the girls are listening to what he's saying for them doing like, oh, we're doing the Titan fights. Okay. And then he's like, okay, I've got the plan. And everybody listens to him and it's like, don't you think the people who've been like here their whole life would have more experience? Whatever. That's one of the little gripes I have with it, but.
Sounds like the book is a little self-aware.
Yeah, little bit.
And you said the tone is more, it's kind of comedic, right?
It's a mix. It's comedy.
Yeah. So what would you rank? Would you rank the individual books or would you just give the series a ranking?
I honestly can't really remember where the divides are between the books. So I would just rank it all in one. I'd say it's probably like a seven. It's pretty good, actually. Okay. If there was more, I would. If there was more and it was like not a smut novel, I'd probably be like, yes, let's do that. I don't know if I want to do that, though.
Are you kidding?
I'm poisoning my Audible, though. My Audible, now it keeps suggesting things. I'm like, no, 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 no. So now I actually have to. It won't happen in the future because now I read the summaries beforehand and I have it all prepped what I'm going to listen to.
Stay tuned for Justin's next leisure list where he talks about his latest smut novel.
Oh, God.
And I'm going to move on to Asteroid City, which is a Wes Anderson film. I haven't seen very many of them, but I know there's some certain Wes Anderson tropes. And this seems to follow most of them. But what is Asteroid City? It is a play within a TV show, within a reality, within a movie. Nobody understands what's happening, but maybe that's the point? That's the best summary I can give. But what do I like about it? I figure Asteroid City's humanity is buried beneath showmanship and heady themes. That is both my commentary and my criticism, because you're following a group of eccentric geniuses who are building weapons for the government. Basically, the play of Asteroid City centers around this science fair where some of the best geniuses of America are coming together and they're building all these crazy weapons. So it's the genius kids and their parents and some of the local townsfolk in Asteroid City. But everyone's kind of an eccentric weirdo. They're not very relatable people, and they all have this level of aloofness to them which makes them hard to relate with on an emotional level. Which is interesting because when it gets to the segmented black and white portions about the making of Asteroid City, where the actors in the play play versions of themselves on this TV show, the actors are a lot more emotive in those parts because they're playing more realistic kinds of people. They're playing versions of themselves. But when the actors are playing their characters in Asteroid City, they're, you know, like I said, there's that aloofness. So it is a choice. These the real life actors aren't messing this up. Wes Anderson must have told them, okay, be more aloof when you're in the Asteroid City portions and be more expressive and emotional when you're playing these actors on the TV show, which must mean something or other. Don't ask me exactly what. But the most trippy one is Scarlett Johansson. So when you really got to think about what's happening here. So Scarlett Johansson is playing an actress who's playing herself on a TV show about the making of a play named called Asteroid City, where that actress is playing a character who's also an actress preparing for a role. So Scarlett Johansson has a very, very hard role in this movie.
So what you're saying is there's more layers to this than Inception.
Oh, yeah. Scarlett Johansson's going about 5 layers deep. By the time you get to the Asteroid City sublayer, that's very difficult on her, I'd imagine. Most everyone else is only 4 layers deep. And funny enough, her character is probably the most normal one out of everybody. If only because I suppose the idea is that her character being an actor is more open to the normalness of humanity. She's an eccentric person, but also she's got to be more self-aware on an emotional level, which makes her ironically more normal than anybody else. But yeah, I'll get more into the plot in a minute. But as far as filmmaking goes, Wes Anderson's a pretty known quantity. He's really good at what he does. He's got an exceptionally unique visual style. It's just every frame of painting in this movie, it's gorgeous to look at. I love the really strong color saturations in it. Just pops, unlike most movies I see that are trying to look more grounded or quote-unquote realistic. This isn't going for realism. It's going for a very heightened sort of vibe. Though the black and white sections, which also look beautiful, they do feel a bit more stripped back and objectivist in a way. I noticed the camera hung out more long shots in the TV show portion.
I wonder if that's to make it look like a TV show more. It's just like more of that typical three-camera setup.
It looks like three-camera setups on a soundstage, but the Asteroid City parts feel like they're actually in an immersive world, which is funny because that is the play. So, once again, I don't know what it means.
The TV show about the play is black and white.
Is black and white and feels like it was shot on a soundstage.
But then the play feels like a
real world.
Okay.
But a heightened version of a real world where all the people are eccentric and aloof.
Over eccentric. Yeah, like a play.
Yeah.
Basically. That's...
Yeah. So all the actors also seem perpetually perplexed in the play Asteroid City. It nearly seems like the actors, I'm not talking the real life actors, but the actors in Asteroid City don't necessarily know why they're playing their characters a certain way, because they never really got adequate information from the writer of Asteroid City. So none of the actors or any of the people making the play Asteroid City know what Asteroid City is actually about. It's sort of just these situations of a bunch of weird people in this town together that nobody really wanted to be in, and they're stuck in a strange situation and they don't really know what's going on, and they just sort of have to make do. It's good dialogue. It's entertaining scene by scene. Although I've heard some people suggest that the fact nobody knows what's going on is sort of the point. It's just supposed to be everyone is trying to find meaning in it where there is none. But also these experiences they had along the way that don't even honestly really change them all that much. They're just sort of, they're trying to find meaning where there is none, and in the meantime, just living their lives, and that might be the point. But also, maybe there is a point. Maybe searching for the point's futile. Who knows? And that's potentially the genius of Asteroid City, but it also might just suck, and who knows? I've heard a lot of people suggest that it gets better if you watch it a second time. It seems to be mostly unanimous that if you watch it a second time, you get more out of it. Whereas a first time, you're just confused.
Are you going to watch it a second time?
Not anytime soon. I'm not much of a rewatch kind of guy, but I may rewatch it again someday. But I do think it's worth a watch. As I said up top, this is the worst thing I watched that I felt like talking about, and even that's worth a watch. The actual worst thing I watched was Halloween 2018. I'm not even going to spend much time on that. I just wanted to say that's the worst thing I watched. Don't bother with that. Although I have to shout out my brother's comment on my TikTok when I made a review of it, and he said that Halloween, the third movie in that trilogy, makes Halloween 2018 look like Citizen Kane. And I already said 2018 one is don't bother. So that tells you how bad the next ones get.
So I watched a while ago a K-drama called Marry My Husband. The concept sounded really interesting.
The title's interesting.
The title caught my attention, which is why I looked at the concept. I watched the trailer and then I'm like, all right. I've never watched a K-drama before. Usually drama shows aren't really my thing, but I'm like, you know what? I'll try it. I'll try anything. So basically the setup for the show is this girl is dying of some disease. I think it might even just be like cancer or something. And her husband and his girlfriend kill her for the insurance money. Because she's gonna die anyways, is their reason.
Okay.
So she finds out in the same moment that her best friend is sleeping with her husband. And then something happens and she goes back in time. And I can't remember why she gets the theory. She has this theory that she's like, okay, She's gone back to before she married this guy. And for some reason, she has the knowledge that based on fate, whoever it is who marries this guy is the one who will get cancer. It's some sort of like fate thing. And she's like, okay, I have to then instead convince her to marry my husband. And they're perfect for each other. And they can, you know, she's like, I don't want anything to do with this guy. Mm-hmm. And she has to kind of relive her whole time before. But now she knows the real, like, who these people really are. She's had more longer experiences with them. She has absolutely no attraction to this man anymore. And so it's very interesting. She has to kind of manipulate them to be together.
So is this a more typical time travel thing where she's actively physically there and has to deal with her younger self? Or is this a Days of Future Past thing where she's in the body of her younger self?
She's in the body of her younger self.
Okay.
She's completely taking her place. She's reliving the same experiences. And then there's this other guy, There's always got to be another guy who is her boss at the company. They all work at this company together and he's the boss. Well, obviously, there's got to be some drama. If she's getting rid of a man, she's got to find a new man. So she's also working to improve herself. She's trying to change herself entirely and do things differently. And she's trying to be with this guy. And the show was really good. Drama's usually not my thing, but I really liked it up until a point where it just felt like they were padding for time because they were starting to get to like the end, and then it's like, oh, we're gonna throw in this guy, the boss guy's ex-girlfriend, and drama with that, and it just felt like it was padding for time. She just came out of nowhere and it was like, okay, did you just run out of ideas for episodes?
It's always weird when they start introducing new characters late into a story.
Yeah, then it's like, well, I don't think this character existed. I think, you know, as far as we knew, this character doesn't exist. There was not a single mention of this girl at all.
And no good reason for her to be there.
No. And it didn't pay off either. And she was just annoying. It just caused drama for no good reason, which is the part I don't like about drama shows, where they just do nonsensical stuff just to have drama between characters. And I can't stand that.
There are certain tropes which I'm okay with, and other tropes which are just padding out a story for no good reason. One of my favorites is like, oh, misunderstandings. Oh, you overheard something that you weren't supposed to hear, completely out of context, or new characters come in to make up drama where there realistically should be none. There is ways to do drama that flow very strongly from the characters, and it makes sense based on you get to know these people, and this is what they would do. And you as the audience member think, yeah, I agree. This is what they would do. And of course that caused problems because somebody else's motivation is completely different. That's just basic drama. Everyone's got their own motivations. Sometimes they conflict. And at that intersection is appropriate drama. And then there's shoehorned in drama that's just for the sake of it, and you can tell it's forced.
Well, if you think about it like a character web, especially for this show, you've got the main girl, her new guy who's the boss, her old husband, and her best friend. All of them have relationships, interesting things between them. They all work in the same place. They all have a dynamic between each other. They all have things, you know, lots of different things between each other. And then all of a sudden you have this girl out here who is only connected to the one guy.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was used to develop his character more, I think it was because it was too late. And it wasn't just a one-off thing. It was two episodes it took to resolve or something like that. And, you know, obviously there's things like she had one-off characters too, where she's like, oh, the girls who used to bully me. Yes, they're one-off characters. But that was early in the story. And this was expanding upon who she was as a character and where the show is about how she's changing, how she's doing things differently this time. And so that made that interesting. But when you have this character who is just nothing, like we already know lots about this other guy. And it just didn't seem to fit. It just seemed like it was.
Well, when you say stuff about the girls who used to bully her, that sounds like the kind of drama that can exist within an episode, be the conflict for an episode.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something else like this, especially if it's just is this a one and done season, or is there supposed to be more to it?
I think it's one and done. It had a resolution at the end, and I can't see there being room for any more unless, I mean, they could play with the concept more. This was a while ago I watched this. I can't quite remember exactly what the mystical element of it was that caused her to go back and have this knowledge that it's like, she's got to work with the fate.
This sounds like a longer, more dragged out version of Peggy Sue Got Married. It's this movie, it's Francis Ford Coppola movie from the 80s. Very similar. She's miserable with her husband, who's like Nick Cage as a teenager in this movie. This is one of his first movies that he ever did. And she ends up getting put back in the body of her 17-year-old self or something like that, and just does high school a bit differently because she's this very uptight person in the future, if I recall, and she played it safe her entire life, and now that she's a teenager again, she's thinking, okay, well, I'm going to play out my future a little bit differently this time. Now I can do it all again. I'm going to be a bit more of a risk taker and see where that gets me. Now I've had a chance to do it all again. Would she pick the same husband she ended up with, who she was miserable with in the future? I mean, now she's seeing him as a teenager, the version she fell in love with, and okay, well, does she catch feelings again, or does the knowledge of how he turns out change things in her mind? It was an interesting movie. This sounds like similar.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It's also a different culture too, because it's a Korean drama. It's a Korean show. So a lot of times with different languages, things don't always cross over. You know, you might get some cross, but then it's like, hey, if we make something similar in a different language, it's a totally different audience it's hitting. So it's pretty good. But for me, it was really interesting because it dealt a lot with like work, the whole working scenario of like Korean offices, which is very, very different from like American style offices. It's the work environment is totally different, and they have a very strict set of
social codes.
Yes, social cues and things they follow. So that was really interesting for me because I've never experienced any of that. And also I had Wei with me, who has been to Korea. She knows a lot of stuff about Korea. So she obviously has more experience with that. So I'm like, is this actually how it is? Or is this show like hamming it up? And she's like, no, that's pretty accurate. So for me, I'm sitting there, I'm like, I can't tell if they're, you know, is this being inflated for the drama, or is this legit? Like,
yeah, it's one of those things where if you asked a Korean what they thought about the show, they might consider it relatively mundane, perhaps. And if you look at you say, well, I don't really know a heck of a lot about Korea, so I'm liking this cultural exchange. If you watched a lot of K-dramas, you might come back to this one and feel it's even more boring, but the fact that it's one of your first, I think, helps make it more memorable. Just because it's something, the whole package is different, just all the culture and everything around it. But what would you give it as a ranking?
I gotta put it at a seven and a half for sure, because it was really good. Maybe if I watched it again, I don't know if I would rate it as high, who knows? But for now, 7.5 is where I would place it.
All right. So, last up for me, besides my quick picks, I'm combining the Addams Family and Addams Family Values from the 90s. And as a brief summation, it's about an eccentric and darkly humorous family who survive and thrive in a beautifully cruel world out to get them, just the way they like it. And what I enjoyed about it, I think it's witty and abundant dark humor, which is totally up my alley. And that all overlays stories about a shockingly healthy family, which weathers the whims of normal people. It's both of these movies are about bad guys who are trying to steal the Addams' wealth by any means necessary. They're plotting and scheming. And the irony of the second one, especially, is that the Addams totally would have accepted this person, if they were right up front with them, they would have totally loved how scheming they were and been like, no, totally, take our money, be part of our family. We actually respect you for how conniving you are, but you didn't think you could be honest with us, and you did this whole runabout plot to get the family fortune. So that's the great irony of it, is that if these people were up front with them, the Adams would probably like it. They're kind of masochists. They enjoy the torture and everything that comes along with that. If anything, being around normal people is more torturous, which is why I like the second movie better, because you got to see them interact more with normal people, specifically the stuff about Wednesday and Pugsley at summer camp with all these rich, entitled kids who just make them even more outcasted, and, oh, you're the weird kids who don't want to participate in anything. Meanwhile, they're going through a family crisis, which nobody really respects because they're already the weird kids. So, oh, their family's weird too, and they're having problems. So, but that all is very amusing. And Christina Ricci, especially in those sequences, is incredible as Wednesday Addams. I mean, she was great as a child in the first one, but the second one was a couple years later. She was even older, better as an actress at that point. And an all-time great comedy scene for me of facial acting is when she's forced into this happy hut where they're trying to condition Wednesday and Pugsley to be good, normal citizens of the camp by just crushing all their negative spirit. And Christina Ricci has to force a smile on her face, and it looks like it's physically painful for Wednesday to smile when she's got this condition, like mental conditioning. And just the feat of facial acting she pulled off is amazing. But a lot of them have great facial, like Christopher Lloyd has a lot of great facial acting and expressiveness as Fester Adams in both these movies.
Oh yeah, he goes so above and beyond, just to, especially under so much makeup, and there's some prosthetics too, right?
I don't believe so. I mean, maybe some on his chin to make his face more rounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was wearing like a bodysuit too to bulk him up. But otherwise, it was mostly just dark. It was pale makeup and eyeshadow. But his is a whole body performance. He's very expressive all the way through. I mean, Christopher Lloyd just sort of is that way in a lot of his stuff, but as Fester, it's very entertaining. He's got a shtick and he does it well. And also, big standouts to me are Angelica Houston and Raul Julia as Gomez and Morticia Adams. And I am willing to rank their romance as among one of the best I've ever seen in any media. I love how contrasting their personalities are. She's incredibly reserved and kind of a melancholy sort of vibe, whereas he's manic and way out there and getting into sword fights with people all the time and doing acrobatics, and he's off the wall and he's very emotional and feels very strongly about everything.
And I think that's what really helps these movies as well, is their relationship is on the surface, you wouldn't think it would work, but when you see how it really works and when they're really like working together,
yeah,
there you're like, I get it now.
I think one of my favorite lines between the two of them is in the first movie, and they open up into the ballroom and Gomez takes Morticia's hand and says, oh darling, how long it's been since the last time we waltzed. And she takes his hand and says, hours. And then they go off and dance. Like, that's the relationship they've got. They're acting like, oh wow, we haven't danced for hours. It's been so long.
It works so well.
Yeah. And I also love the quick wit in these movies. Talking about Gomez, it just reminds me of another line that made me laugh a lot, where somebody from the in the second movie was trying to flatter Gomez as a charmer, and she's, "Oh, you're such a lady killer," and he just rapid fire says, "Acquitted." Yeah, it just a lot of dialogue peppers these movies like that. It's so fast, and you know, even just a one line punchline like that is very okay. That was very efficient writing. And the second movie, I think, even more than the first, is tight in terms of its dialogue and setups and punchlines and payoffs like that. It's just the first one is really funny, but the second one is an even better written comedy. And even though the plot of the second one meanders a bit more, it kind of bounces back and forth between two unrelated things. There's the summer camp plot, and then there's the bad guy trying to steal the family fortune, which don't really relate whatsoever. But it's a more entertaining and funny movie all around. The first one, in fact, suffers, I'd argue, from being more focused, because I didn't really care about the bad guys in the first one. The bad guy in the second one is actually really entertaining, but in the first one, they were just kind of boring. And whenever they took screen time away from the Adamses, it made the movie worse. I just don't care about these people. And in the second one, the Adamses got more opportunities to interact with normal people, as that contrasting for their eccentricities. But in the first one, the bad guys were really the only quote unquote normal people they got to interact with the entire time. So it was a little bit disappointing in that regard. But I think the second one took what worked and cranked it up a little higher. I also love the production design and makeup and lighting in all these movies. One of my favorite details is on Morticia. She's lit differently than everybody else in her scene. She's got this light on her face that accentuates her eyes, like you see in 1930s Dracula movies or whatnot, that kind of highlighting the eyes for extra dramatic effect. And she's always lit like that in every scene, in both movies. They highlight her to make her look like a classic horror movie villainess. And it's just specifically for her. And I don't know if I've ever seen that in a movie before so blatantly. And I know it's done for comedic effect, but it's also done as an homage to old monster movies. But the house, the mansion, it's wonderfully gothic and dark and Halloween-esque. It's creepy. The costume design for everybody, the special effects work, especially for Thing. I don't know how they pulled that off 30 years ago. The hand that runs around on its own. Some of the comp work on it was a little bit sketchy for some shots, but most of it looks really good still. It holds up. There's a lot of practical effects in these movies that are still very well done. And a prominent theme in both is, once again, the Adams, despite being masochists and loving the torture, are a shockingly healthy family unit. They're a lot more in tune with each other and help each other. These outside people are a lot more toxic and cruel to each other. And despite Wednesday and Pugsley always trying to kill each other, and it's like a game nearly. All the bad things they do to each other are playful and just part of the family dynamic. And then these outsiders come in and they're just actually bad people. The Adamses aren't necessarily great people either, but they're not pretending to be any different. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is just what we are. And we're actually a pretty good family, all things considered. You guys are broken people trying to, like, you need money because that's all you got. Especially in the first one, where this the bad guy was this character who is, well, Christopher Lloyd in the first one, he's playing a, he looks like Fester Adams, so he's infiltrating the family, making them think he's Fester Adams. And they all kind of know that he's not really Fester, but they still accept him into their family anyway. They because all know that he's
acting like one of them.
Yeah, they all know he's probably a con man, but they still accept him for who he is anyway. Like I said, the same thing with the villain in the second one. If she had been as upfront as that, they would have accepted her too. They don't really care that these people are trying to screw them over. It sucks for them when they do, but the Adamses are very warm and welcoming people if you're in their family circle. So both these movies are very entertaining and pretty darn good. Dark humor, right up my alley. Love that stuff. Looking forward to the next season of Wednesday too, whenever that comes out. It's been a while.
It'll be soon. It'll be soon. Knowing Netflix, it'll be pretty soon.
Yeah. So what you got?
All right. So I talk about Audible so much that I should damn near be sponsored by them at this point. But one of the things that most people know about Audible is their celebrity read audiobooks. And one of the most popular ones is Andy Serkis reading The Lord of the Rings.
I've heard of them. Yep.
And somehow I've gone this far into my Audible journey without any of them. So I finally listened to The Hobbit, the Andy Serkis version. And it was great. It was excellent. The Hobbit was one of my favorite books growing up. And Andy Serkis does it justice for sure. I mean, he's great. When he's doing Gollum parts, he's great. He's the voice of Gollum. If he didn't do those parts good, that would be...
not worth the price of admission.
Yeah. But he's got that deep voice, and it's just nice to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with Tolkien's prose writing, it really sounds a lot more like poetry, the way it's read. Especially the Hobbit. The Hobbit was more poetic than the rest of The Lord of the Rings ended up being. And that's from its origins in Norse mythological stories. They're all written, like most of them actually are poems.
Mm-hmm.
That we've translated into stories now. And so having Andy Serkis do it, like just the way he does it is so well, like he's definitely doing justice to Tolkien's writing. And it was definitely an experience. It was great. It doesn't quite make me want to rewatch the Hobbit movies because three of them was too much. It was too long. But the book is great. And it's always going to be great.
I still haven't even seen Battle of the Five Armies.
You can skip it. That one,
I'm gonna because I'm a completionist, but I...
it's just so disappointing that they just...
I mean, doesn't the actual end of the Hobbit book end within the first 15 minutes of Battle of the Five Armies? Something like that?
Well, the problem with Battle of the Five Armies is that, right, Smaug is defeated, and there is a back section. But before the battle even happens, Bilbo gets knocked out. And, like, it's the build-up, you've got all the politics kind of going on, and then he gets knocked out after he meddles a little too much in things he shouldn't have been doing. And he misses the battle. He's just told what happened afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of disappointing that the movie was like, we're going to show all this.
Of course they
were. We're going to show everything. And I don't know. And it was bringing the culmination of all the other little things they added. Like, oh, Legolas is in there. Keeley's got a relationship with an elf or something. And, you know, there's this specific bad guy after them in the movie. The I can't remember what he is. He's an orc or something. And all of that kind of comes to a head in that movie. And it's like, these are the things I didn't want to see. This is,
I see,
you know, all of the late stage additions just are in that movie. They're most integral. And it's because they needed to pad it for time. That was the movie they needed to pad for time. And they know that nobody would watch it if they killed Smaug in the second one. They didn't want to finish it in the second one because, I mean, what do you do after the big quest ends with the dragon fight? Like, there's not much after that.
Yeah, pretty much. But did you listen to Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or both?
The Hobbit. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he did all three of them.
Yes, he's all. Yeah, there's four books.
Four books?
Oh. Yeah, because there's The Hobbit and then there's three Lord of the Rings books. And
I meant The Silmarillion, too. I'm pretty sure he did that one.
I've never been able to get through The Silmarillion. Maybe I could.
If Andy Serkis narrated it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I've never been able to get through it, despite The Hobbit being one of my favorite books. And I love Lord of the Rings. But I just couldn't get through The Silmarillion. It's so
wordy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tolkien's gone too far with his prose.
Well, you made it through the weirder Dune books, so
that's true.
And is the Silmarillion any worse than Frank Herbert rambling later on? I haven't read them, but
no. Frank Herbert starts to kind of lose his mind at the end. But yeah, maybe now I could go back and actually get through it. I would probably appreciate it a lot more. But I'm going to work my way through. I'm going in order. So I've got the Fellowship of the Rings next. That'll be eventually. I will listen to that.
Yeah, that's a blind spot for me in terms of classic literature. I mean, there's a lot I should read, but The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings is definitely something I ought to at some point.
It's not a long book either. It's really short. When you take the books and you're like, here's Lord of the Rings, it's stacked up this bloody high. And then there's The Hobbit that's not even as big as one of the books. But the adventure is so packed in there that it's like, I do understand how they made two movies. Not three. Two? Except three? No.
I think it's hard to condense a novel, especially an adventure novel like that. People get mad when you condense an entire novel into one movie, basically every time. I don't care what it is. I've heard complaints about every single one, let alone a fantasy novel with such dense lore to it. So, two movies, okay. But, yeah, try to imagine condensing one book to one movie.
Yeah, that definitely for The Hobbit, that would be really, really difficult. Unless they cut large portions out. There is enough to fill two movies.
That is why I'm a proponent of miniseries for adaptations of books. I always think those are perfect. You get 4 to 8 episodes to tell a novel-length story, especially nowadays when miniseries are of such high budget. Unfortunately, the writing quality has been lacking in most entertainment the last decade, but there are good ones. Can you imagine an adaptation of The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings with Rings of Power money? By somebody who was competent?
No, I've definitely seen more book adaptions done well. Like, the recent adaptions have been better when they're in a miniseries.
Like, they're making a Harry Potter TV show. I'll be interested to see that.
I know there's a lot of debate about it, but also feel like they might be able to do it more justice, probably.
The first movie came out over 20 years ago. That's okay for a reboot.
My only problem is I don't think this might be a hot take, but I was big about Harry Potter. I read all the books, I watched all the movies. I don't think that the books were written as well as the movies were.
Well, I only read the first five books and only saw the first five movies, and I remember the movies more. I'll say that.
Yeah.
I was never that huge into Harry Potter. That's one of those weird ones where I always liked it, but I was never as rabid about it as everybody else in our age group. I digress. So my last thing I'm going to talk about today is my quick picks, and I've only got one worth talking about today, which is Action Comics, Volume 2, The Arena. So the premise of this book is Superman is losing his powers, and this is the second volume of the Warworld saga, so there is a couple issues before this, and there's going to be more after this. And the Warworld saga, even at this point, is among my all-time favorite Superman stories I've ever read. Not to overstate it, but the premise of this book is Superman is losing his powers, and he takes the Authority, who are a group of anti-heroes, basically, to space to fight Mongol and free the prisoners of Warworld. And then they end up getting captured and basically doing Superman mixed with the plot of Gladiator. So Superman becomes pretty much like Maximus, who's trying to lead a prisoner rebellion. They call him Bloodless Sword, which originally they meant that as an insult, but then people start getting inspired by his gladiatorial prowess and the fact that he doesn't kill people. And then the Authority, meanwhile, are trying to... Well, a lot of the Authority are also gladiators, but then a couple escaped. Others are too injured to even fight. And it really builds up Warworld as a place. They've even got some of their own unique language, some of their own lore. They have entire religions and philosophies about combat being the way of life. Every one of them wear chains, which... They're proud of their change. Every time someone tries to break them out of their chains, they're like, no, this is like a point of pride. Every time I win a battle, I get a new link on my chain. The longer the chain, the more prowess you, the more social status you have in this society. And Superman and the Authority look at this and they're like, yeah, but you guys are prisoners. You do realize that, right? The fact that you have big chains that you refuse to break is... Like, to us, that's just a symbol of your oppression, not a symbol of social status. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of philosophical conflict about fighting as a way of life for these people. And then Superman comes in there with the audacity to try and free them from that. But a lot of these people don't want to be saved. Fighting is all they've known for a very long time, and this is... And being gladiators of Warworld is all they plan to be. The art's gorgeous. As well, I love the visual style of it. The dialogue is poignant, and it puts Superman into very strong moral situations where he's not necessarily... I mean, he is the one in the right, but also it's more of a challenge than usual because people disagree with him. And that was the same kind of conflict I loved about the first set of the Warworld saga, which I'm sure will continue into the next one when I'm finally done with that. So, Action Comics, The Arena. Read as soon as possible. And that does it for this leisure list. When you're done flipping through, where can we find you?
This is actually really gorgeous, the artwork.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very impressed by it. I like how each section kind of has like a different kind of color scheme. Like you can kind of get vibes from it just by flipping through it. Like each,
you can tell
portion,
as-
like there's a portion that's mostly reds here. And then there's a portion that goes into the browns. And then there's a portion that's like there. There's a couple pages in a row that are all this blue color. And then it fades back into the reds again.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of... I've read quite a few comics. But I really like some of the close-up shots in this. like extreme close-ups.
Oh yeah.
I've never seen a lot of those done in comic. Not extreme close-ups where you're just on the eyes. Like
true.
Eyes are generally hard to, it is very hard to show an emotion through eyes that are drawn. But just looking at some of the extreme close-ups, I can, without having read anything, just looking at that image, I can tell what's going on. Like that one is excellent.
Determination.
You can yeah. already just tell. I know exactly what's going on just by seeing how the characters are responding in the moment.
Yeah.
I'd probably read that one actually. That looks really good.
Yeah. So the first two volumes of the War World Saga read ASAP, but I'm specifically talking about the arena today. And where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm.
And you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. And check out thoughtplane.ca for everything else I do. You can even donate a buck or two there if you like our work and you're feeling generous. Buy us a candy bar. We hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe, where Justin and I debate the Clone Wars versus the Bad Batch plus Rebels. We're combining the two of them to give them a fighting chance. So, till next time.
Take care.